from the front lines. We've been very happy at KPFK and Pacifica has allowed us more time than usual to come down to Mississippi and do essentially a special set of interviews on the 50th anniversary, 50th commemoration of Freedom Summer of 1964. One of the many pieces of black and revolutionary history that's been sanitized by the U.S. And so we want to go back and find real people who are doing real things. And also try to understand how they're seeing the present political period based on the struggles, the victories, and the sum up of the summer of 64. So today I'm talking with Leroy Johnson, who's the executive director of an organization called Southern Echo, who has been a very important figure in the movement, in the black movement, and in my view has been somewhat of a transition between the summer of 64 and the present generation, but with more ties to it than a lot of people have. So Leroy, very nice to have you on Voices from the Frontlines. Why don't you tell us just a little what you do now, but I mainly want to go back.
Well, thank you. What we do now is we work on issues around voting rights, which go all the way back to 64, and why the summer of 64 was so important. And it moves us to this whole question of the civil rights movement around voting rights and moved us to a real place of citizenship. And this question of first-class citizenship versus third- or fourth-class citizenship, I've never figured out what was second-class citizenship because I never knew what second-class meant. I knew what third- and fourth-class meant because we never even got to second-class on the plane, on the train, on the bus as a part of the process. And so this question of voting rights has been essential to the founding of Southern Echo because we started this organization around the question of redistricting in 1989, looking at how do we look at where we were and the possibilities of the change that was coming to this country. So we looked at this opportunity to look at the census work of 1990 and then looking at redistricting in 91 and 92, and that if we took advantage of what the laws were and created out new laws as a part of that to extend those laws, to make those laws real, and will give us a real opportunity to make real change in terms of elected officials here in the state of Mississippi and for policy changes in the state of Mississippi.
Well, let me ask you this, that during the 60s there was a lot of talk about a black nation, about black self-determination. From afar, one of the things that's been very confusing to me is that it seems like the black voter is trapped inside majority white states that have now left the Democratic Party, moved to the Republican Party. And so on the national electoral scene, essentially the black vote has been voided a lot in the South. So it seems to me, I'm asking, that one of the things that black organizers tried to figure out is, well then how to get black power in areas of black concentration, and therefore the fight over redistricting is very important. Is that fair? Is that, you think, an accurate way to, or how would you talk about it?
Well, I think that's a fair way to talk about it. I think it has unfair consequences,
right?
It's a fair way to talk about it because the truth is the truth.
Right.
Part of what we look at, right, and understanding is that those places where we have the numbers, we need to make those numbers real, right? And then in making those numbers real, then this question of the revenge of the Confederacy, of the Confederate states taking us
back
as a part of a process. And so from one of the things that we've talked about here and in our analysis is that there's a Dixification of America going on.
That's right.
So it's not just about all of the things that are bad about the South are now being transported to the rest of the country, right? Never would have thought that Michigan would become a right to work state.
That's right.
You never would think that Wisconsin would become a right to work state. When folks were leaving here, getting out of the South and getting out of dirty Mississippi, it was this whole question of trying to go north and trying to go to the West Coast and trying to go to all these places, right? Migrating out of the South to go to these places where they had the opportunity to work and build kind of a real living rather than still having kind of the sharecropper mentality and the slavery mentality of the South. And then now we're transporting all those beliefs and all those types of what I will call the stupidity of intelligence, right? The super smart folks who think they know more than everybody else, right? Are creating a myth about the South that now the South is winning, right? And so, you know, the Civil War was only, not that we lost it, right, in the South. The answer was, is that we discontinued it until we can figure out how to win again and how to take those same beliefs that they had as a part of the Civil War and putting them forward in the U.S. And right now it's fertile ground for those types of what I call inhumane kinds of thoughts from those who are supposed to be the intellects of our society.
Well, let's now go back to 64, because I was there, not in Mississippi, but as Fannie Lou Hamer said, you know, you're fighting them down south and up north. And one of the things we thought at the time, obviously, was whatever the solution was, it had to begin with the black vote. So how is your understanding of it? You told me before that you were six in 1964. Tell me about your perception of your father, if it's okay, at seven, and your perception of the movement, because you were in the movement in some way. You were a seven-year-old black child in the middle of the Civil Rights Movement. How did you see it through your own eyes?
Well, I had this conversation with Fannie Lou Hamer, and one of the things that we talked about, she said, boy, you just a lap and pallet baby of the movement. So that is what I've always thought of myself, as a lap and pallet baby of the movement. So the idea is, as a child, is that you're running around these meetings, and my dad believed that as the oldest child, I needed to be learning about what he was doing, right? And I needed to have a sense of a history of what this country was, and specifically what was going on in the South, right? And so I thought that this was a lot of old folk. Right, when you're 7 years old, and my dad first came into this process in 61, when SNCC came to Holmes County, right, and you're 4 years old, and you're 3 years old, you're three and a half, kind of things. Most of the time, you're spending running from one lap to the next lap, other part of these meetings, and I couldn't necessarily figure out what they were doing, but when we went home. And my mom be asking the questions of what you're getting this boy into. You're going to get my child killed. And he was be saying to her, look, this is important, right? This is important. And he needs to understand what it means to be black in America, right? And what it means to have a nation where you serve your country. Because he was a soldier in the Korean, they call it a conflict. Now they call it a Korean War, but it was only a conflict back then. Right. I don't know how you... You know, just like I got a year older, well, the conflict turned into a war. That's right. 30 years hence, right? It becomes a full-fledged Korean War. And coming back to the U.S. and coming back to Mississippi and not even having the right to vote, right? So you could fight for your country and not even have the right to vote. It was alien to him, right? So he couldn't figure that part of it out. And so the whole question of how do we get there, right? And so this whole place of voting becoming the transportation or the visa, right, to first class citizenship was one of the things that he thought that he had to be a part of, and that he wanted his oldest child to understand it in that way. And so being a part of those meetings were things where I know a good thing about it is they started with a good song and they end with a rousing song. Right. They started with a good song, you know, a good church song, and then they ended with a wonderful rousing song that left everybody up as they were on their way out, right, to go to work.
Well, those songs recruited me to the movement, you know. Wake up this morning with my mind,
yes,
set on freedom, you know, and all those songs. So I totally agree with you, the black movement knew how to sing. I think one of the things that's very important is that I've been doing a lot of reading lately again about Mississippi Summer. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm getting clearer and clearer on is the large numbers of people who were armed and the large number of people who came out of the army You know, and that holds a better understanding of the impact of World War II and Korea on the civil rights movement, because contrary to the myth, even when people were using the tactical nonviolence, many people were packing guns in their car, and even more had guns to protect their house. Tell us a little bit about the sort of, not conflict, but the duality of violence and nonviolence among black folks in the South in 1964, 65, 63, in that period.
Well, the wars were fought as wars of aggression. And I think my dad was one of those who believed in self-defense. And he said that I cannot be a part of the movement as one of the nonviolent ones, but I can definitely be part of the movement as the ones who protect those who were nonviolent. And so this question of, in Holmes County in particular, was this question of saying, we will defend our homes. Don't we have a right to defend our homes?
Right?
Don't we have the right to defend our churches? Why would you burn down a person's church? Why would you burn down a person's home just because they wanted what you had in relationship to a right to vote? We didn't want their money. We didn't want their women, as they, you know, try to call out, right? We didn't want any of those kind of material things. What we wanted was the right to vote. And to defend that, my dad thought it would be less of a man not to defend that. To defend my religious belief, to defend my home, was part of who he was.
Was he affiliated with the civil rights movement?
Yes, he was.
Because, like, when I was with CORE in Plaquemine Parish in Louisiana,
yeah,
there was Deacons for Defense. And I remember,
yes,
James Farmer getting up there and saying, hey, I'm nonviolent, but I want to thank the brothers for Deacons for Defense just in case, right? So was your father armed and affiliated?
He was consciously armed.
Okay.
He was non-consciously affiliated,
right?
Because they wanted to make sure that there was a difference.
Absolutely.
That there was a hard line between those who did and those who did not.
Right.
That sometimes got blurred in Holmes County,
right,
because some of the most fiery leaders of the movement in Holmes County, Hartman Tumbo, was like, I'm shooting back. You come down this road where I live at, you come down Dawson Road, and come down here to the end of Dawson Road where I live, and you start talking about shooting, we shooting back. Talking about throwing a bomb in my house, we shooting back. And he did. And so he was arrested and thrown in jail for setting a fire to his own house and shooting the volunteer fire department folks who were trying to put it out.
Right.
That's what he was arrested for.
Right.
So there was this kind of line in between the two in terms of how do you do it, but those lines got blurred. Robert Cooper Howard, the same thing, when they came to his house and told him he was not going to be sending his children to the public schools, it wasn't going to happen, and they start shooting, he started shooting back. But he was a member of SNCC. He was a member of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And so it was easier, right? My dad never became a member of SNCC,
right,
as much as he became a member of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party.
Right.
Right. And so that was the place where the lines remained blurred and was blurred in a way that the number of shootings into houses and the number of shootings into the folks' homes were decreased, and the number of churches burned in a place like Holmes County was less than places all over the state of Mississippi, and mainly because there was a defensive edge to the work in Holmes County. And there was discussions around it at SNCC about how do you do it. And Hollis talks about having to make a decision about how do you talk about this this nonviolence to folk, but at the same time, the folks saying to you, the folks ain't gonna burn down my house.
Right.
Not with me not fighting back, right? And folks ain't gonna shoot at me, and I'm not gonna shoot back, kind of thing. And so there was all of these kind of deep arguments about what it meant, but folks being very, very clear, when you live there, then you had to kind of take on the mantra of the folks who were there and who was going to have to be there after you left. And I think that's the important thing of understanding is that we spend all this time talking about commemorating this 50 years of Freedom Summer. It's many communities who where the folks remained, and white folks lived in black folks' houses beyond Freedom Summer,
right?
And before Freedom Summer. And it's like the way that the story gets told, now the myth gets told, is that it just happened that summer.
Right.
You know, I knew we have plenty of times where folks who were who we call freedom fighters, and dad and them called freedom fighters, lived in our house. We had a 3-room house. And, you know, I come home and we were trying to figure out who are these folk and why I got to sleep on the floor tonight. You know, why don't they sleep on the floor and I'm sleeping in the bed while all those guys have a pallet on the floor and they sleeping in the bed. What's wrong with this picture? I thought this was where I lived, not them, you know, as a part of the process. And so it was all those types of things, you know, were part of that whole process. And there has to be a recognition of the people who stayed and the people who had to go through all of the things that they had to continue to go through even after Freedom Summer, right? And even after black folks and white folk killed to register black folks to vote in the state of Mississippi.
Well, one of the things that was said is that Cleve Sellers, I believe, said that when the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party went into the Atlantic City Convention, they went in as a civil rights organization, they came out as a black liberation organization. They went out in trying to reform the Democratic Party, they came out wanting to build something independent of the Democratic Party. But I know it's been a very complicated process because easier said than done. You know, the Black Panthers tried some things in Alabama. Having lived in Mississippi your whole life, which I assume, by the way, is that true?
Not quite, but mostly true.
Okay.
Right? I mean, there were a few outskirts when I was an outlier to my own state, but if you, when you put them all together, I was probably out of state 3 years.
Okay.
Right? So I spent all of my life here in the state.
So you're 1 year older, but 3 years less. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll get on math.
Get
on
math.
Get on math, right.
Yeah, that's right.
So, well, having lived in Mississippi, you know, most of your life and obviously being shaped by that entire culture, when did you see the transitions happening? Because there was a time when the 60s ended, where the Black Panther Party was basically defeated militarily, where in 1970, I call it the two decades of the 60s, from 55 to 75, basically, and then 55 was Montgomery, Emmett Till, the Bandung Conference of Non-Aligned People, 75 was the Vietnamese victory against the United States, being of Jimmy Carter moving towards Ronald Reagan and the counter, what I call the counter-revolution. When did you sort of come of age in Mississippi politics? Tell us now, when did you think you were a primary actor?
Well, I became a primary actor in a real way when my dad decided to run for elected office. And he decided to run for elected office for County Board of Supervisors, which is the County Commission office, in 1979. And he asked me at the time if I would run his campaign. And part of running his campaign was he said that he had to engage a younger group of folks to vote. That if he was looking to win with the old heads, he was not going to be able to win.
Right.
Because they were stuck in between an alliance to the white supervisor who had been there for 20-some years at the time, and at least 5 terms, and working on his winning his 6th term in office. And he had created a kind of a patronage system where he had really determined, even in a black majority district, where black folk couldn't win the district because they owed him.
That's right.
Right? And so my dad was saying, look, you went to school, we had all these folks at our house. You know, we always had a big grouping of folks. You always were involved. You were always a student activist. You always were getting in trouble. Now let this trouble work for us. And so he asked me to come and be a part of electing him to office. I had just gotten out of college.
Where did you go?
I went first to Mississippi State University. Me and another classmate, we were going to be the, from our communities, from the Delta to, you know, black folk going to Mississippi State, right? And I went from Mississippi State for a semester and ran afoul of the of my dean Department of Business and Finance, and I called him a racist in class because he was telling me that I was smart and intellectually good, very good student, but I didn't belong in business and finance. That wasn't what black folk did. And I should be like my other classmate from the Mississippi Delta, from Chula, right, to go to farming and agriculture department. Or he said, I would be wonderful in political science. I would make a great lawyer, but right. I won't make a good banker, financier.
So Booker T's ideology moved up a little bit, right?
A little bit, right.
Right, but not, you got promoted, but still.
Got knocked down, right? That's right. It wasn't even like, okay, a glass ceiling. Right. It was a clear ceiling. That's it was right. A white ceiling. And the white ceiling said, no. And so they put me on in that position, right, as a part of the process. And so I ended up going to Mississippi Valley State University, getting my degree. And I stayed in trouble there, too, right? I stayed in trouble at Mississippi State, stayed in trouble at Valley. But I left Valley and went to grad school at Michigan, University of Michigan. The university, that's what the folks say, they're supposed to say when you officially become a graduate. I didn't officially graduate, so that was a good thing, right? But I came back to my dad's campaign. And we came, we reintroduced those young folks, you know, basically folks who were 18 to 28. And we spent a lot of time generating a process within the older community and me generating a process within those young folks between 18 and 28. And we won. And
what was the vote? What was the margin?
He won by 147 votes, which was basically a landslide as a part of the process, right?
Right.
And nobody thought he could. Nobody thought he would. White community didn't think he could. Black community were divided on whether he could or not. And the majority of them thought he couldn't. And especially the remnants of the SNCC-led folks and and the Freedom Democratic Party folks thought he wasn't. He was the wrong one. He was the wrong Johnson. There was another Johnson who supposed to be it, but it wasn't that one.
Well, wait. Let's take a minute. This is very important because the trying to tell it like it is. So some of the graduates of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, were they supporting the white candidate or another black candidate?
Well, yes, they were tacitly supporting the white candidate because he said that to his last term he had gotten too old and he wasn't going to run again.
Right.
Right. And the argument was James, who was my father, it was a James, you shouldn't be running now. This is his last term in office and we've already selected with him who from the black community who's going to be the heir apparent, right? And who's going to transition into the job of supervisor. Right? And they had done those types of transitioning processes inside of Holmes County, right? They did that with the superintendent of education. For the first black superintendent of education, it was a transition process. It was who the white community had selected along with, quote unquote, the right folk in the black community having an agreement, this is the person, right?
Oh, it's like the grooming.
Yes.
Right, the white community grooms the black successor.
Yes.
And
who's going to keep many of the same policies in place.
So your father.
So you change and not change.
So your father wouldn't wait.
He wouldn't wait. He dared not to wait.
He dared not to wait, like
and,
you said.
Yeah, he dared not to wait, and we won. And so that shocked the white community, and it shocked
that's
the black
right.
community. Especially the leadership of the black community. They were like, it wasn't supposed to be you. You shouldn't have done that. And then there was some anger, real anger from them towards him around it. And then actually in the next election, the folks who it should have been ran against him. And we won.
You won again.
We won again. And he kept winning. He won 5 terms. And he won a 6th term. And then he died in office.
Let me ask you another question, which is, what becomes the content of black politics when, like, in terms of your father?
Mm-hmm.
Did he run as an economic populist? Did he run, were there any civil rights edges to his work? Or did he run, well, the basic question I'm asking is, what were his politics?
His politics was seriously around race equity. And he was saying it was time up for the plantation politics. It was time up for slavery politics. And it was time for a black man to be a black man and stand forward as a part of the process. In the state of Mississippi, up until 1984, you had to own property to run for county commissioner.
Wow.
And so we had a little property, which made us independent poor folk.
Right.
We were independently poor. See, nobody helped us to be poor. We were independently poor. Right. We did it ourselves, right? So we were very independently poor and on the little land, and that qualified him to be able to run for office. And he won, and his politics was clear. One of the things my dad always talked about, and he was very, very good about, he said, "I'm not going to let politics take me to hell. I'm going to tell the truth. I'm going to tell the truth to everybody, black and white. Whether you liked it or not, I'm going to tell you what the truth is as I see it. And if you can change how I see it and build me a case that says this is different, then I will change. But unless that happens, we're going to go with a politics of hiring black folk. We're going to go to a politics of building a process where black folk get the same type of roles that white folks have, right? That the law applied to white folks just as they applied to black folk." And he was unapologetic about it. He was so strong about his, what I would call his liberation front, that it scared the black leadership, who came to him quite often to say, "James, you got to tone down your rhetoric." And he said, "This ain't rhetoric, this is the truth. And you can't tone down the truth, you just tell it."
And that's pretty beautiful. It's also pretty unusual because we're talking 1979, did I get it right?
Yeah, and he took office in 1980.
He took in 1980. Now, in 1970, I believe, was the first black political convention, and there was discussion of black power, and there was discussion of running for office on a theory of black power. They even had a thing called It's Nation Time.
Yes.
You know, by 1980, most black candidates were running a non-racial campaign,
exactly.
Right? They had been advised that that's suicide, you know,
that's
especially
right.
If you're in a district that has white voters. Downplay, just say, "I'm working for everybody. I'm the same as my other candidate. You can be sure that if I'm in office, there'll be a continuity." Did anybody write about this?
No. Folks have pushed me to write about it, and in the transition out as the ED of Southern Echo, I'm thinking about beginning to put some of this stuff down and talk about what this transition means. Talk to other folks. You know, folks have seen me as a bridge between these movements, right? And talk to me about having an opportunity to understand that and be in places that I shouldn't have been in, but glad I was in them. And being a part of seeing history unfold in front of me with wonderful folk. When I spent a grad summer at Antioch College in Yellow Springs, and to have as my teachers during that summer, Ann Braden, Jim Dunn, Reverend Douglas Frederick Kilpatrick, all these folk who were talking about help us make a nation through the humanist movement, it was wonderful. It was wonderful to learn at their feet, to garner in, and then add that to my understanding from Fannie Lou Hamer and my father and those folk who were part of the Mississippi movement was huge for me. And then being able to then think about it from an analytical sense is how you put those pieces together to make sense of what your work is presently. And that's part of what we've been trying to do.
Well, the reason I'm going back a lot on history, where I'm almost not talking about Southern Echo, because there's a perception that, yeah, back in the day, but not anymore. So the other thing I would say is to encourage you to write. I am a writer. I've done 7 books, a lot of articles. Every time somebody says something to me, I say, "I'm going to write that." My wife says, "Would you stop making everything into a writing project?" But I think a lot of black people in particular and low-income people don't perceive themselves as writers. And yet, we need a new generation of writers. And I would really think, Leroy, that the almost the transition of the spoken word, which is how I try to write. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I write and then I say, "Does that sound like how I talk?" All my books end up sounding like how I talk. So I think that's a fascinating, I'm fascinated by it, and I'll buy the first copy.
Okay. Sound like a deal.
Okay, we got a deal.
Sound like a deal.
All right. What's his title? It's working title.
Well, his working title is "There's No Right Way to Do Wrong."
Woo! That's pretty good.
Well, that's what my dad used to tell me all the time.
I know. Your agent will like it too.
Yeah. So he was always saying to me, "There's no right way to do wrong." Right? He said, "I don't care how you do it, it's still wrong. I don't care how slick you get at it, it's still wrong. I don't care how intellectually you make it, it's still wrong. So there's no right way to do wrong." I used to have to talk my way out of stuff, and he said, "You just were wrong." And so I think from that standpoint, I've always thought about it in terms of writing this piece around him about there's no right way to do wrong. Right? That would be the epitome of what he lived and how he lived it. And so I think that's what I'm looking at.
Well, this is Eric Mann on Voices from the Frontlines. And I think, Leroy, it's also true that you have also understood there's no right way to do wrong. And your history in the South, your history throughout the United States, your reputation, which is, when we die, the only thing you got left.
That's all you get.
Right? And I want to say your reputation is quite strong throughout the United States. And I look forward to figure out the next part of this book.
Thank you.